Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is the author, Richard Hanania, who is the president of the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology, and has written a fascinating book a couple of years ago on the origins of wokeness. Richard, hello.
Hey, Ed, good to see you. It actually wasn't a couple of years ago. The book's only been out for a few months. But everything else is right.
It's only been out for a few months. I'm sure when I was reading it the other day, it said 2022.
It should not have said that.
Maybe it was pre-released then or something like that. Anyway, well, it's only, I don't know. I must have misread it. It's only been out a couple of months anyway. So The Origins of Wokeness, the book on the origins of wokeness, and it's fascinating stuff. And we're going to discuss that today. So you've been very vocal on what you see as the stupidity of conservatives, and yet the conservatives are huge critics of wokery, and you're dismissive of wokery, but the stupid conservatives oppose wokery.
Mm-hmm.
So would you rather live under a stupid conservative regime or a woke one?
It depends on what the nature of that conservative regime is. A woke regime versus, say, something like Putinism, which is, you know, conservative in a way. I think I'd rather take the wokes. If it was maybe some red state American government in the Anglo tradition, I would take the stupid conservative. So, you know, it depends on what exactly we're talking about.
Well, what is it that makes the conservatism stupid?
You know, I think that there is a, you know, what is it that makes the conservatism stupid? So what I write these articles, and one of them that I wrote, I think I most specifically on this topic is called Liberals Read Conservatives Watch TV. I'm talking about sort of the culture that surrounds, you know, the elite sort of 5% that are having a conversation. Right. And so a lot of these ideas that, so you can start with the basic fact that liberals actually read high quality publications that get their facts right and actually, you know, rely on data and produce a lot of material like Fox, the New York Times, the Washington Post. These equivalents don't exist on the right. What the equivalent on the right is, you know, talk radio, TV. A lot of the obsessions are very superficial. They're tied to people. I see in conservative media sometimes speculation. I'll just take one example that, Michelle Obama or Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic nominee because they're going to push aside Biden and bring in Michelle Obama. Now, liberal media, whatever else they do, they don't sit there and speculate that Laura Bush is going to be the next Republican nominee. There's just some things in conservatism that are just completely divorced from reality. There are stupid things. You might say, well, liberals have, you know, systemic racism and these other ideas that are bad. I agree with you. They're bad in the way that, you know, communism is bad. But these are sort of the kind of mistakes that smart people make when they have a faulty ideology that they follow.
Yeah, I was thinking the second you said that they are what my colleague Bruce Charlton has called clever, silly ideas, aren't they? These kinds of ideas, they are ideas that intelligent people will adopt in a liberal context in order to optimally showcase their intelligence and their liberal credentials. They're different from stupid ideas. In a way, they're quite intelligent.
And I think that if you gave an IQ to, you know, we have people have, you know, they can do IQ tests of Democrats, Republicans. They have some of the data, or conservatives, liberals. I don't think that really gets to it. That's too broad. You know, I think that if you took the average consumer of conservative media versus the average consumer of liberal media, I don't think anyone's done a study that is that narrow. I would say that the consumer of liberal media is going to be smarter just based on the content, or at least not as intellectually lazy. I think there's some smart intellectual laziness sort of combination that makes people conservatives or liberals.
But that's an important distinction, though, isn't it? Because presumably, if you're going to say that conservatives are stupid compared to liberals, then you kind of have to control for intelligence. Otherwise, it's just a reflection of the fact that we live in a liberal society. Intelligent people are perhaps more socially conformist, better able at norm mapping and forcing themselves to conform to the current thing and then competitively signaling it. So in a liberal society, the liberals will inherently be more intelligent. So surely you have to control for intelligence. You have to say, what are intelligent conservatives doing wrong that intelligent liberals are doing right?
Well, part of it is that there's not enough of that. There's not enough of intelligent conservatives. There's not, you know, if you wanted to start a right-wing version of, you know, Vox or the New York Times or something, I don't know if the market would be there. So it's not, I don't know if it's that conservatives haven't, you know, done these things. I don't know. It's a chicken and egg problem. I tend to think if the market was there for it, it would exist.
why would you rather live under a woke regime than under a Putinist kind of regime?
You know, I think that basically there are just some basic things having to do with good governance that are not directly tied to ideology. And Anatoly Karlin makes this point. I recently talked to him. You know, I studied abroad in Russia one semester when I was a undergrad. And you know, they told us, you know, the police are basically, if you have any interaction with the police, I don't know what Russia's like today, but we were told at the time we were sort of safe because we were American foreigners. But basically, any interaction with police, they're going to try to get a bribe off you. Like, they're not there to help you. You try to just avoid contact with them as much as possible. They'll sort of subtly ask you for a bribe, but if you show them your American passport, they'll maybe leave you alone. But for like the average Russian citizens, they'll just have to give them a few bucks to move on. This is unthinkable in woke America, right? The institutions just simply function better. So I think there is this, and I think it is related to sort of, you know, is this just corruption versus non-corruption, or is there something inherent in conservatism that makes it like this? I don't know. I mean, the wokest countries, like say Sweden or blue state America, they don't have these kind of problems usually that you see in these sort of corrupt sort of states that maybe are just closer to human nature. And corruption, you know, plus sort of nationalism and religion, those are all sort of related. And so anyway, things like liberals have gotten away from
independent. It's independent of wokeness, isn't it? I mean, the things that are going to predict corruption are going to be things like low intelligence, low social trust, which is very low among Russians. Sort of tribalization. There's various factors that are going to predict corruption, and wokeness will tend not to develop in those societies, I suppose, because wokeness is kind of top of the Maslow's
hierarchy. Yeah, I think so. If it requires intelligence and it requires sort of broad thinking, yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a good, you know, some good example in sort of American politics where I think that sort of the Trump movement is sort of like closer to that sort of more like extreme corruption, you know, a Putinist way. If you look at, I don't know if you followed the attorney general in Texas, who was just impeached, and the Republicans, that, you know, he ended up not getting convicted in the Senate, but this guy was purely corrupt and all the whistleblowers were Republicans, and they basically, you know, they had a detour. He did everything wrong. And they couldn't convict him just because, you know, the MAGA sort of movement just made it a big thing. Oh, this is a deep state conspiracy. They're going to take our guy down. You know, this is the kind of thing that you don't see as much on the left. There was a
senator. You just had the case of this this gay woman who was found to have, you know, not only have abjectly failed to condemn mass, you know, hugely anti-Semitic acts on campus, but to have plagiarized about 50% of her published work. And a lot of people on the left, well, not a lot of people, but a significant group on the American left refused to condemn her and implied that it was some sort of conspiracy to keep her down because she was black.
Yeah, well, she was. I mean, she was fired in the end. There was some people who said
fired.
She's
remained an academic at the university. I mean, she's not even been. She's just been changed. She just doesn't have that job anymore.
I mean, it's a bad case. I think you have to. You can compare different. You can compare a university professor / president versus sort of a politician. You know, it's sort of you can get into the different comparisons. I would like to make just a more direct comparison. When the when the senator from New Jersey, Bob Menendez, was just indicted, he's now polling, you know, like 5% in the Democratic primaries. The entire Democratic Party turned against him. It doesn't work like that on the Republican side. They are much more accepting. Even Democratic senators have called for his resignation. He hasn't resigned yet. It tends not to work as much like that on the Republican side. And so I think they're not all the way to like Putinism, where it's just like corruption. It's all just, you know, who's ever, you know, got friends in high places. But it is sort of closer to that spectrum. And I don't think it's completely independent of ideology.
Okay, so speaking of ideology, you have a particular sort of historical model of the development of wokeness. I've looked at it in my research in terms of things like genetics and changes of that kind leading to a more individually oriented society, but you have a particular model of wokeness that you set out in your book. So could you possibly explain what that is?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of explanations in any social phenomenon. You know, nothing's going to be exclusive. I buy that there could be, you know, genetic changes over time. I had a podcast with Joe Heinrich who talked about the, you know, changes in Western civilization. I think there was probably genetics, although he denies that part of it. There's been, you know, an evolution in the last, you know, several hundred years or so. I think, you know, from David Reich's work and others, there obviously was. So there, yeah, this is a sort of a multifaceted issue. And I think people, you know, can take the argument sort of too far. I don't think that, like, you know, every racial problem in America is based on civil rights law. Now, the way that sort of all our institutions became obsessed with, you know, inequality on a few dimensions and the definition of inequality and discrimination that they focused on, I think a lot of that you can tie very directly to civil rights law. So the idea of disparate impact, for example, that if you give a test and one group does better than the other, that test is racist and we can't have, you know, a standardized test in government or schools or whatever. That's very, very, you know, I think you can show the direct sort of line there. Affirmative action and government contracting, you could look at government basically, you could look at the historical record and show government forcing sort of race consciousness, sex consciousness onto institutions like universities and corporate America. And then you could see the rise of sort of lawsuits over time, right? Wokeness sort of comes later, but sort of the ideas of wokeness are part of law long before they're part of the culture. Another thing is just even how we classify, Americans according to race. I have the data showing that these categories like Hispanic, Asian American, they really didn't exist until government created those categories and they became broad categories. I think the sort of the black issue was always there in America. I think one of the stronger claims in my book is like every other identity other than Native American, the big ones that we think about, Asian and Hispanic, those were basically.
Well, certainly there was a clear distinction that was made and understood between black and mulatto. There were mulatto colleges for mulattoes. It was a significant self-identity that you were a mulatto rather than black. And that has been completely subsumed. No one talks about
mulatto. It's actually a good point. I didn't bring it up in my book, but yes, I never thought of that. But the fact that there aren't these distinctions within black as much anymore, at least officially, is also sort of a case for that too.
Yeah, there's some very interesting research. A guy called Lipton Matthews, who's Jamaican, has brought it to my attention.
I know him.
Books on the social class system among blacks and how it's sort of a pigmentocracy and all of this sort of thing. What is it that is particularly original then about your argument that you felt you needed to present that point? Because it seems to be fairly clear that this is a system of competitive signalling where we have got from Martin Luther King, you should just be treated not according to the colour of your skin, but according to the content of your character or your intelligence, down to now them saying we want equity, we want equal outcomes. And it's just a natural progression, isn't it?
Is it a natural progression? I don't know if it's a natural progression. I mean, the value added here is sort of showing how laws and regulations and court decisions that are not seen really as that important at the time. A lot of the stuff I point to is very, very sort of obscure. A lot of people would know it's something, regulation passed to the Labor Department or some law passed that, nobody was paying attention to, did not make the newspapers or anything like that. But they changed the incentive structure. I think the 1991 Civil Rights Act is a good example of this, which changes the culture and the environment of corporate America. Eventually, some people become, true believers after the incentives are created. But I think that just the ways that it's sort of these sort of, sort of pedestrian everyday sort of governance decisions can end up having a long-term impact.
So it's highlighting the meta effects of what seemed like quotidian decisions at the time. So can you give me some examples of those then that people might not have heard of?
Yeah, I mean, so there was something called the Civil Rights Attorneys Fee Awards Act, which basically said that if you sue, in a civil rights lawsuit, the winner gets to get their legal fees covered. So if I sue you and I said you're hiring me and you discriminate against me, and you pay for my lawyers too. You don't just pay me what you owe me. But then the Supreme Court ruled that this only applied to the person who's suing, not the defense. So then, the plaintext of law would say either one would get this, so you created this sort of one-sided incentive to accuse people of racism, and then you didn't have this disincentive where, the other side wouldn't, for the other side to defend itself. Punitive damages created under Civil Rights Act of 1991. So you didn't even have to tangibly hurt someone. Like it used to be just at the start of the civil rights regime, you would just if you discriminated someone for a job, you didn't pay them enough, you would pay them their back pay. Then it became punitive damages where you just had to pay them because you were a bad person, because you discriminated. Stuff just having to do with sort of the burden of proof of how you prove disparate impact, how you proved something, was discriminatory just because one group did better than the others. There's a lot of these sort of little examples that go, and you can see sort of the percentage of civil rights lawsuits that are filed and the effect of it. It's sort of cool. You can trace this stuff.
I see. Yeah, and also, I mean, the jury system can become a bit of a problem in an increasingly tense society like that, can't it? I think there could be pressure on jury. I mean, with the Derek Chauvin trial, for example, there's now a lot of evidence emerging that he wasn't responsible for the death of George Floyd, but he had to go to prison. And the jury, it was obviously very clear to the jury that if they didn't convict him, then there would be a massive riot in their community, and there were guards outside the courtroom just in case they found him not guilty. So the legal system, in a sense, has come under pressure, hasn't it, of this whole development?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an extreme case. I don't think there are many civil rights lawsuits. If you don't find Coca-Cola was discriminating based on race, I don't think they're going to be riots necessarily. But it's something to worry about. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's a concern. Why do you think that wokeness has? I mean, it's really only since about 2010 that the whole concept has really taken off in an enormous way. And only since about 2015 that we've started here, or about 10 years, less than 10 years, that we've been hearing about transsexuals all the time. Why do you think that it's taken off so enormously?
You know, I think that there's something connected here. You know, I'm becoming more convinced that social media has made, you know, young girls miserable. And wokeness has gone along with that. And, you know, it's sort of the question of sort of whether wokeness leads to misery or misery leads to wokeness, or so they're sort of the same kind of package where you just have this negative outlook and you're just, you know, terrible. And you think it's terrible and you apply it to social problems. I think there's definitely something that happened there. I remember the early days of social media when you would have these videos of, you know, like the Michael Brown and the, you know, Trayvon Martin thing, and you'd have like these confrontations between police and black men. And, you know, they would start the video, you know, somewhere near the end, you don't know what happened. And then they would say, you know, this black man was just pulled over for, you know, driving his mother to church or something. And then, you know, like the police is, you know, racially harassing him. And these things would go really, really viral. I think we've seen, so I think it was a social media. I think it just energized a lot of people, just the new video technology where you could just blast it out to the world, and people, you know, this stuff can, you know, get a lot of attention. We've seen a little bit of a sort of a, since Musk bought Twitter, we've seen a little bit of a reverse of that, where like the sort of conservative boycotts have started to succeed for the very first time. And, you know, these sort of like, you know, these sort of, you know, we haven't had a lot of these police shooting riots since then. I don't think it's an accident. I think that the role of social media, Twitter in particular, is huge here.
Why do you think it makes young girls unhappy?
Well, I think that the best evidence on that is probably having something to do with not politics necessarily, but like looking at you know, other girls, seeing how pretty they are, seeing how much fun they are. You know, women have females in adolescence, you know, young adulthood, it's hard enough already. I think that they're basically just comparing themselves to other girls and just getting miserable.
Okay, and this makes them more inclined towards resentment and therefore anything to do with leftism, yeah. And also more inclined towards anxiety, and therefore uber social conformity is a way of dealing with it, and wokeness is a kind of uber social conformity. Is that what you mean?
Maybe. I mean, you know, which way the causation, you know, goes is hard to say, but the phenomena of wokeness and sort of just overall unhappiness seem to be related.
Okay, so speaking of wokeness, you know, you're anti-woke now, but when you were younger, you were even more anti-woke.
That's one way to put it.
You went for it severely. You wrote under the name Richard Host about eugenics, about sterilization, about the problems of race mixing, and there are real studies on this stuff. Did you say anything as Richard Host that was empirically inaccurate?
Not that, you know, I don't remember everything that I wrote. There's probably something there. It's not so much that some of it was probably, you know, some of it probably was, but that's not sort of the, you know, that's not sort of the basis of my distancing myself from that writing. You know, there's no necessary connection between believing in biology, believing in the importance of genetics, and believing in, you know, sort of group identity. I mean, there's nothing necessarily there. You might think, you know, you need a smarter society to be successful. You might think this or that. You might look at data, but it doesn't necessarily lead you there. I think that, you know, I think that there, I think it, my thinking was too zero sum. You know, if you think, okay, people are low IQ, you know, to go straight to, okay, let's sterilize them.
Or well, you wouldn't, presumably, I haven't read your Richard Hurst articles, but presumably you didn't go straight to let's sterilize them. Presumably you noted the problems that are inherent in a population that has low IQ. You had the certain priors about the importance of civilization. Yeah. You realized that to keep the civilization at an IQ that is just keep it going at 100, you'd have to sterilize a third of the population every generation. And that's what you argued. So I'm saying, what made you decide when that information came? Why do you want to distance yourself from these points if they're empirically accurate or logically argued?
Well, because there's first of all a value question, right? Whether we want to just by any means necessary keep the IQ what it needs to be. I also think that there wasn't enough attention. I think a lot of people who get into sort of biorealism or what HPD or whatever you call it don't realize is that a lot of the reason that other people can be burdens to their fellow man is because of laws and institutions that we can change. So if you're worried about the burden on the welfare state, well, I'm a libertarian. I don't like the welfare state. I mean, that is what makes people burdens, right? And you might say, well, then, the people with lower IQ are going to vote for the welfare state. Well, actually, a lot of them don't vote. A lot of, a lot of them aren't really paying attention to policy. And so you got to worry about sort of.
They may well rise in the streets, steal and create a corrupt society.
That's the other thing.
Like if you go to a low IQ society, it's chaos and it's difficult to get things done for that reason, isn't it? It doesn't have to be the other welfare state.
Look, Bukele went from a murder rate of 50 per 100,000 to 6 or 7 within a few years. Why don't we do that? We had basically no crime compared to today, 100 years ago in the UK and America, right? It's this decadent ideology that I see as the main problem. You kill someone in these Northern European countries and you go to jail for 10 years, you should be executed. I mean, it shouldn't even be a hard question. The fact that we're so sort of soft on these issues, I think, is the problem. And so I think it's the welfare state plus the sort of softness on crime.
We had a different population 150 years ago. The IQ was probably about standard deviation higher than it is now. The populations were monoethnic, and that tends to militate in favor of social trust and public goods and things like that.
I want us to get smarter. I think that a positive way to do this is to be pushing for embryo selection, to be pushing for genetic engineering, to fund this stuff or at least allow it and sort of make it better known. I'm all for that. We should be trying to make people better. I think there's a path to do it that would respect individual liberty and not lead to forced sterilization. I mean, that's how are the low IQ populations going to react to that? I mean, you have to take that into account too. I think there's potentially more moral and sort of less problematic paths for getting to where we want to be.
So what made you change your mind? What made you just change your mind about these, that you don't think it should be done via these kinds of coercive means?
I had always understood sort of libertarian economic arguments, seeing some people who accepted sort of, IQ, but also being more accepting of open borders. I think it shifted me a little bit on this because it is sort of there is still the comparative advantage. There is a comparative advantage for trade, even if people come together, just like reading more history, comparing GDP across the world, like seeing that Japan and Sweden are like poor compared to the United States. People argue with me on this on Twitter, but a lot of these people are denying basic GDP figures.
Japan has a low crime rate.
Well, good. I mean, that's good for them, but they're also poor. They're also poor compared to the United States.
Presumably a balance has to be struck. So you can be very, very rich. We can maintain a high level of wealth and a low birth rate. Which they do, they have a very low birth rate, and you can maintain wealth, but then you have to have immigration. If you have the immigration, then you undermine the ethnic continuity and the sense of social trust. But then equally, those three things have to be held in balance, don't they? What you're suggesting is that the most important thing is just wealth.
Well, I mean, wealth is pretty important as far as people's revealed preferences. People move from poor countries to rich countries. You know, it's not like people aren't coming to the United States because the crime rate is too high. You know, they still want to come here. So people will go to a high crime, high wealthy country. And it's not like the US, you know, by the way, if you're not living like within one of these urban centers, you know, your chances of being murdered are not very high. It's not like America is, you know, this dystopia that a lot of people think, even though our overall murder rate is higher than a lot of other countries. And so, yes, you know, I think, you know, the crime rate can get so high that it can make life unlivable if the entire country was like Detroit or Chicago. But those are huge, huge outliers. Most Americans can afford to live far away from that. And you know, wealth is one consideration. Crime is another consideration. You know, the social trust, I think, goes both ways. I think social trust can lead to sort of more welfare spending, and I think I've argued that's one of the reasons why the U.S. is much wealthier than its IQ would predict, because there's a backlash to welfare spending because of our diversity. So it's not predictable what the political consequences of a more diverse, you know, society with less social
You've
trust.
said that the cost of crime in society, but folks, let's talk about that. Now, you said that El Salvador's recent successes in combating this, and your argument was basically something along the lines of, I mean, there was a British Home Secretary, Michael Howard, that said this: prison works. So, why do you think Western governments are so reluctant to just lock up criminals? I mean, keep them away from society during their most fertile years. Everyone wins, don't they?
Yeah, I mean it's a white guilt thing. I mean, I think the Constitution was written, you know, I think that the Constitution in the United States, and I shouldn't probably go down that route because it's all Western countries have these problems, and the non-Anglosphere countries are often worse. Yeah, I mean, there is a sort of a Nietzschean line about like the society becomes so decadent and starts to sympathize with the criminal, you know, the person who would, you know, do direct harm to it. There is, you know, I think that it is just there is sort of a you know, part of it is the crime is not, again, not that high unless you're like, you know, living in an urban area or something. You know, if you're living in one of these black inner cities, for most Americans, it's manageable. So there's not like constant demand to do something about this. And I think there's just a general softness for us to, you know, come down hard on people or groups of people. And then, you know, and then even if the consequences are better, you're going to get a lot of people who are in denial of that fact.
Why can't they see? I mean, the brilliance of El Salvador is that you just get all these people that are criminals, and other countries as well have adopted this policy, and just lock them up. And there's no that's I it seems to me extraordinary that anybody can be so blinkered as to not see. We used to lock them up. Well, even when we had a much lower crime rate. Is it just that we're too rich? Is that the problem? People got too much resources that they just don't care about these things?
You know, it's the general left wing ideology. I mean, why do we provide, you know, welfare that causes, you know, sort of bad incentives for people to, you know, have children out of wedlock and all these other things? Yeah, I mean, these are sort of, you know, these are sort of beliefs of a society that's disconnected from reality to a certain extent, can afford to be disconnected from reality, especially the, you know, upper classes that make decisions about these things, even though if the long-term consequences of society are bad. And so, yeah, I mean, why we just don't all realize this and, you know, do the right thing on crime is a good question, but you know, it's a broad one with deep, you know, sort of historical explanations.
I mean, you mentioned as well that the main places that have high crime in America are black, which is statistically true. Places like I was on this place in Detroit. What was it called? The 7 Mile Road, or something like
Eight, I
this.
think it's eight, I think it's 8 Mile. I know from the Eminem movie.
From Eminem, I don't know how many miles it is, but it was. There were areas of it that looked
Oh,
unpleasant. But yeah.
there might be a 7. 8 Mile is the another
And
one.
it's, it's, I didn't get out the car, and there were areas of it that were nicer. But you've written that everything that liberals believe about race depends on lies on top of lies. Could you elaborate on what those lies are and why they're
Yeah,
told?
I mean, you start by denying group differences. If you show group differences, like say on an IQ test or something, you have to argue that the test is racist. You will lower the standards, and then when you lower the standards, you bring people on, and then you have to sort of lie. There was I don't know if you've been following this Mark Cuban drama on Twitter, but you know, like people just would keep arguing with him, and I think he's just embarrassing himself, where he'd say, you know, DEI is actually about giving people opportunities, not about, it's not in conflict with meritocracy. And then, you know, you'd show them a piece of evidence, and you'd show them that, like, for example, Black doctors are disciplined, you know, a lot more than white doctors. And he would have, you know, he had some stupid rebuttal to that that didn't make sense. And so, like, you have to sort of just, you know, these group differences, you just have to sort of pretend they don't exist, but then you have to lie. You know, you're putting your thumb on the scale throughout society and every step of the process. And then you have to just, you need a lie for every single thing that happens. And you're in denial about, I mean, what you're doing. I mean, just like the basic fact of racial preferences, the way these universities, they say they have to defend affirmative action, but nobody actually gets in because of affirmative action. I mean, it's absurd to people.
Amy Wax, who I've interviewed on The Jolly Heretic. And she apparently said to somebody, a female Black person or something, oh yeah, you're a double beneficiary of affirmative action because you're Black and female or something along those lines. Mm. And this woman complained about this.
Yeah.
And it was considered so offensive and so egregious. How dare she say that this person was there because of affirmative action, but then they want to have affirmative action. They want to have affirmative action, but you can't possibly, because it's so self-esteem sapping, to admit that, oh, you're in Harvard because you're Black. And a more intelligent white person has had to go somewhere else so you can get in. And presumably they do badly in Harvard as well. I would imagine that they don't do as well as the people that have got there on merit. So it's an appalling, what's that noise? Why unplugged something accidentally? If I don't. It's a quite appalling. It's my computer. It's a quite appalling system. But how have these lies managed to be so successful? Because I mean, until really recently, until the '50s, everybody understood these things. Everybody normal had an understanding that there were race differences, and that they were partly genetic in nature for the most part in these kinds of traits, cognitive ability, personality. Why do you think that the American culture has been so successful in suppressing something that when the information's out there, everybody can just see it with their own eyes?
I don't know if 50 or 60 years ago people assumed racial differences were genetic. I think Bayesian anthropology and sort of these ideas that there were no group differences. I think they're earlier than that. I think maybe in elite circles.
Well, he was publishing them in the 20s, and so they started to, I would say, spread into the culture by the 50s or 60s.
Yeah, I think elite culture versus mass public culture is different things. I think among elites, the most sophisticated elites, I think probably by the 1940s, I would guess a majority probably thought that racial differences were, I don't know, majority. I don't have any polling or data, but my impression is that, you know, a lot of elites already were sort of, you know, into blank slateism. A lot of elites were communists, right? A lot of them were spying for the Soviets and such. So that was part of it. People don't like genetics in general, right? Like even in racially homogenous countries, if you ever talk to people from East Asia, you know, you ask them, do they believe, you know, that genetics determine some people are rich and some people are poor? And most people tell me that they, you know, that East Asians, they think anyone who's, that's why they torture their kids, because they think anyone who studies hard enough, you know, can do great things academically. So I think people just dislike sort of genetics. I mean, a lot of people don't even buy Darwinism. I mean, there's a religious, opposition to these things. And then there's from the left, there's this, you know, sort of desire for equality that, you know, people don't let people cling to. And so, people believe what they want to believe generally, not what necessarily is true.
True. But what is extraordinary is the degree to which they can see it with their own eyes. They can that you have to have, for example, quotas in order to maintain a relatively high number of Black people at elite university or as doctors or whatever, but yet they believe two things at the same time that are contradictory.
They don't think about it that much, because it's just like most people are probably just in most situations are just like, whatever will cause me the least trouble. If someone is complaining loud enough, they probably have a point, or at least you give them what they want. I mean, I have an article, Women's Tears Win in the Marketplace of Ideas. I think particularly when it comes to women, we're genetically programmed to maybe not be so tough on them and to sympathize with them. And it works like that with, you know, ethnic or racial groups. too. I think most people just, some people are true believers and, you know, sort of the egalitarian dogma. And some, most people probably just want to be left alone and are conformist. And I think that together explains it.
Well, there are some people that try and fight against it. And you've actually been quite critical of these people. You've written on anti-white bias. Fine. Yeah, but yet you, as we see here with the university admissions we were talking about, but you've also been critical of white identitarians.
Yeah, so I don't. Yeah,
who are trying to combat? I mean, their raison d'être, isn't it? Is trying to reassert the power of European descended peoples. So, what would be the best way to combat anti-white bias?
I mean, to the extent that anyone wants to fight, you know, affirmative action, wokeness, all these other things. Great, you know, I support that. The idea that there is sort of a white sort of collective identity and that you should advance the interest. Well, first of all, it's too zero sum in its thinking. You know, I think that there's nothing logically inconsistent with saying I care about white people the most. And so I think we need anti-aging technology and embryo selection to make whites as smart as possible. Like that, you know, that would be something interesting. But in general, when most people become white identitarians or identitarians of any kind, what they do is they start thinking in zero sum. They start thinking of, okay, we have to maximize our percentage of the population. Is it going to be a socialist government? Is it going to be a capitalist government? Well, whatever. It's just as long as whites have the greatest numbers, you know, we're going to have trade, even if it benefits both sides. If China gets off a little bit better than us, or if Mexico gets off a little bit better than us, then, you know, then trade is bad. So I think that it's to the degree that it's correlated with this sort of zero sum thinking, I'm against it. If people just prefer whites, you know, in general, but want to make humanity better off and are thinking clearly about how to make humanity better off, you know, I don't necessarily oppose that.
But why does it have to be humanity that's better off? Why can't it just be their subgroup within humanity? Because from an evolutionary perspective, that's what you would expect people to do. You would expect people to, their locus of identity would be in concentric circles around self. They would care, they would be at the center, then it would be their family, then it would be their extended family, then it would be their friends, relations, then it co-ethnics, and so on. So wouldn't you actually expect them to act in such a way as to optimize their genetic interests by optimizing the interests of their own subgroup before humanity as a whole?
Yeah, I don't know if the, I mean, I don't know if there is, you know, this is sort of an is this this is gets close to sort of the is ought distinction, but you know, I'm not sure even the is true here. I'm not sure necessarily we have that instinct to any great degree, or if we do have that instinct, that it's, you know, for example, like you don't have to, you wouldn't, if people have this, you know, desire to help their own race, or like this, you wouldn't have to convince people of it. Like you don't have to convince people to care about their families or their children's. You need laws against nepotism. People will sacrifice a lot for that, even their local communities. This idea that, like, you know, white Americans will care about, you know, New Zealanders or Ukrainians because they have the same, you know, they look the same and have the same genetic background. I don't know if there's a strong basis for that, if that instinct
exists. There's a number of studies that have shown that, yeah, where you the people operate in terms of genetic similarity and do so down to quite fine-grained levels, even within families, and that the most primitive part of the brain reacts differently when shown a stranger of a different race compared to a stranger of their own race. So yeah, it does seem that we are in some way evolved towards acting, yeah, in the interests of our ancestral population, race, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, about those baby studies, I don't know if it's just, you know, people with babies are used to, right? If you've never seen a black person, maybe it's different. It doesn't mean that you necessarily, as a white baby, are scared of black people. Naturally, it might just be you haven't seen that many black people. All your family, you know, look white. And so, the question, you know, there's studies that you can show. There's also studies that show, like, for example, that, you know, and I've written about some of these, and I've done one of these studies in the foreign policy context, that, like, white liberals prefer black people. Like, they'll save more black lives than white lives. So you're going to say that's not human nature? Well, I mean,
that's an interesting point. That's an interesting nuance, isn't it? Because presumably within a group, you are going, there was a paper, I think it was Waits, W-A-Y-T-Z, Waits. And I think it was written with Jonathan Haidt. And they showed that the conservatives are broadly group oriented, so they will identify with their, you know, their ethnic group or whatever. The liberal will identify with those that are further removed from self, yeah. i.e. different ethnic groups. And this is because they're individualists. And if you identify with different ethnic groups, then this allows you to be basically a traitor, to collaborate with outsiders and thus attain power within your own group. So you have those that are the conservatives, it's these binding moral foundations, they're group oriented. The individualist, he's individually oriented, he wants power within his own group. And one method by which you can do that is to collaborate with outsiders against your own group. So that would make sense, actually, that liberals would identify, and you get this with extreme liberals, they identify with different species over their own, but certainly with different ethnic groups.
Yeah, a liberal would have a different explanation, put a different spin on, you know, that kind of research. They would say we're the morally evolved ones, and we see that, you know, species should have, other species should have rights, and we shouldn't make animals suffer needlessly. I'm sympathetic towards that. I don't believe in animal cruelty, even if they're not genetically related.
I don't believe in animal cruelty, but I had a chicken curry for dinner tonight, and it was delicious.
Yeah, I eat meat. It's also delicious. I try to eat the larger animals.
These ones here, because for the ripping off of meat from bones.
Well, I mean, you could look. You could point to other parts of the body and say this is for doing what I want to do to women. Right? I mean, it's
part of my body that's there to be moral towards animals, moral towards my own people. Speaking of my own people, one of the people that gets a lot of stick is Joe Biden. Because he's old and people say he's got pre-senile dementia. And there is some evidence of this. One of the things that's very noticeable, if I compare America to Finland, I mean, I live in Finland, and until quite recently, we had what I call the Spice Girl government. You know, you had these five young girls, all of them under 40, who were running the country. A few of them were quite pretty. In America, you don't have that. You have much more of a kind of gerontocracy. Mm-hmm. And it's you've had three elections it will be in a row, where presidential elections, where all of the candidates are over 60, and indeed in the last two, over 70. Can you explain what is a gerontocracy and why are certain places in the West, particularly America, it seems to be America more so than other places, but it becoming a gerontocracy politically?
So there's two things here. There's the way government is set up, and so some of the gerontocracy articles have focused more on that, like the contours of our welfare system and how they redistribute wealth. That's one definition of gerontocracy. What you bring up first is sort of like just who happens to be in charge. I think that part of this in the American context is just we directly elect the leaders of our parties. In the UK, a lot of countries, it's a parliamentary system where you vote for the party and then the party picks the young, dynamic, good-looking guy. If we had that in America, they would probably pick Marco Rubio or Paul Ryan for the Republicans, and the Democrats would probably have some, you know, moderate governor. We elect our leaders directly. The people like brand names, and that's why McDonald's is everywhere. And so the Republicans really like Trump, and the Democrats really like Biden, and we have relatively weak parties, and we give more power directly to the voters. I think that explains sort of the what's going on in electoral politics.
You've never had a situation where they've been so bloody old.
I mean, people haven't lived that way.
Barack Obama was under 50. George W. Bush was his early 50s. Jimmy Carter was early 50s. JFK was all of them. It's 50s, 40s. And then suddenly you've had all of these people they're in their 70s. Now it's a new phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, you skipped over Reagan, who was much older.
Reagan was the one I skipped over. Yeah, Reagan was 69 when he was elected.
And you had McCain was the candidate in 2008. I think he was pretty old even then. Yeah, he lost, but
he was dynamic young.
So we have a very small end problem here, right? If we're just looking at presidential candidates,
True. But you were saying a broader issue to do with distribution of wealth more broadly, though, gerontocracy.
The other way to think about gerontocracy, which I think is more important because it doesn't have the small end problem. It's more how society is set up. Our welfare state, if you look at sort of just where the money goes, it goes to Social Security and Medicare. It goes to old people, right? It's like 40% of the budget or federal budget or something like that. Everything else is, defense, interest on the debt, all the programs for the poor. It's a relatively small part compared to just sending old people checks and, you know, paying for their health care. Now, old people are the wealthiest demographic in America. They have the most money saved up. So it's a very regressive system. You're redistributing, you know, it's a bit perverse in a lot of ways. You're redistributing from the poor to the wealthy, but you're also redistributing from the time of people's lives where they can reproduce to the time of their lives when they can't. We also have anti-discrimination laws. The way wokeness and, you know, civil rights law usually works is that the group that's poorer gets the advantage. Old people are protected against age discrimination, but they're wealthier and they have seniority and they have better jobs than young people. So if you just want to, you know, fire the old people, give the young people a chance, even though the young people are as a class poorer, you can't do that. You could be sued for that. So you have all these sort of advantages, you know, that that pile up, even like housing, you know, the way we don't allow new housing, which really favors those who bought their houses a long time ago. We restrict the supply, the prices go up like crazy. Nobody but anybody young, you know, is going to have a difficult time buying a house. And so this, you know, I think that there's a, you know, I don't think it's just necessarily about like we're consciously doing it for old people or old people are voting their interests. I don't think it's like that. I think it's like we have a status quo bias where like we have a loss aversion where we protect sort of established, you know, privilege. We think it's terrible if someone loses their job, which we care a lot more about than if someone never gets their job. We think it's terrible if someone's house loses value, but we don't think it's as bad if someone can't start their life and start a family. We just, you know, accept that. And so this is something that, you know, is, you know, I think people need to think about carefully. I think it's a broad problem with our society.
And so, and it's beyond America then, this problem, isn't it? I mean, in England as well, the price of housing, because of credit, because of mortgages, and because of the selling off of the council houses in the UK, has gone up enormously. And then you've had immigration, which has put pressure, enormous pressure on housing, and the housing has not kept up with it. So the population has exploded. That's an interesting point, actually. In Europe and America, there is increasing concern about immigration, and there is increasing concern about assimilation. And you have growing far right, or whatever you want to call them, ethno-nationalist anyway, civic nationalist parties. Most recently in the Netherlands, the anti-immigration party, Geert Wilders, the party van de Vrijheid, what became first in the election, and currently they're negotiating as to whether he might even be prime minister. But you are increasingly relaxed about immigration.
I think it depends. I think it depends on the context. Yeah, I think it depends on the context. I think in the American context, you know, I've done some a little bit of analysis. Like if you look at the children born today versus the, you know, estimated IQ of immigrants, you know, you're losing maybe a point per generation. Probably who's breeding is probably more important. You know, what sort of the fertility patterns are of different classes of society is probably more important for the future of the country than the country's future IQ than immigration. In the European context, the Africans and Muslims in particular seem to have a lot of problems assimilating. I think that's a much more complicated issue there. You get to some numbers in France and some other places where, you know, you could see the real problem. So it really is a context specific.
You're saying that you would be relaxed about immigration in America because it's mainly Hispanic and these people are about 50% European on average, and the
Yeah, and there's a lot of high skill immigration too to the U.S. Like you look at the founders of our major, you know, the startups, and it's, you know, some people say, well, just have the high skill immigration, but it comes as a package. The people who want to restrict one kind of immigration tend to want to restrict the other. So yes, in the American context, I don't worry about it that much.
Do you not think that it's in some way damaged the unity and social trust and whatever of society that you've gone from being what 90% white to about 50% white in the 70, 80
you know,
years.
There's a question of going from 90% white to 50%. What are we debating now at this point in history? We're debating if we restrict immigration today, being 55% white versus 48.2% white, right? Is that going to determine, you know, the future of the country? We're already there. You look at just the births, you know, the kids under 5 years old. We're already there. Nobody has a majority, so you know that's to me is not. It's different if you're going from a homogeneous society to heterogeneous society. Now we're just moving the numbers around a little bit.
Well, yeah, but the numbers of the percentage of whites based on their birth rate will get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until you're on current trends, and eventually the founding group within the society will be a very small minority, like happened in Kazakhstan when the Russians flooded it with Russian immigrants and whatever, and they went down to being about 30% of the population at one point. And
yeah,
and
so I mean, I want, I'm pronatalist. I want, you know, groups, and I want, you know, the people best able to provide children to have more kids. Yeah, I mean, it's a problem, but it's, you know, just you want to just, there's a lot of problems too. If you just say we're going to do a declining population, we're going to decline, you know, 25% of the population, 30% of the population per generation. We have to get, you know, deal with the problem that, you know, smart people aren't having kids. People in general aren't having kids. We should focus on that. Definitely.
Why do you think smart people aren't having kids?
You know, I think it's hard to say. I mean, because there's, you know, I think it's partly, it's everywhere. It's a problem everywhere.
Do you have children?
Yes, I do.
How many do you have?
I have two.
Yeah, so do I. And I wouldn't want to have more. So I have to think to myself, why don't I want to have more? Yeah. And it's expensive and complicated. So... You know.
That's true. Yeah, but it's I for the record, I hope to have more. I think it's the simplest explanation is probably the correct one, which is it's opportunity cost because it's happening everywhere. It's like there's a lot more you can do with your money and your time. If you're living in one village and you're never going to travel within 2 miles from your house, what are you saving up money for? What are you going to do with your time? You're not going to take vacations. You're not going to do anything, right? So I think that people just had nothing really to do, especially women. I mean, they didn't have jobs for them. There wasn't much to do other than create children. So I think there's an opportunity cost here. In the long run, I mean, there's going to be selection. I mean, you of course know this. There's going to be selection for there's going to be selection for people who want children or who are, you know, more pessimistically are too irresponsible to, you know, avoid having children if they don't want them. I think that hopefully, you know, technology can make it so, like, you know, when you can design your own embryo or you can have embryo selection, that could probably raise the incentive. I think a lot of people worry about having screwed up kids, even if they themselves are smart. You know, they could have a kid who just turns out bad. I think doing away with that sort of problem and, you know, promising people or making upping the odds for them to have, you know, high quality offspring, I think probably could help. And so, yeah, I think opportunity cost is the main headline here. And yeah, it's a problem that's...
They could make an incentive structure so that if people that, let's say, have a master's degree or higher have three children, it is cheaper than having two children.
You know, Hungary did something like this where they would forgive your taxes. It was by income, right? So the more you made, the more you would save. We'll see how the experiment turns out. It hasn't had massive impacts. It seems to have had a little bit of impact, but maybe it's a long-term thing. I'll keep watching that experiment.
Well, the thing is, the most intelligent people, they don't have any children at all. It's not that they have a small number. They have none. So yeah. There's something they just don't want to have children, full stop,
sometimes I think there's something going on with the sexes, because, you know, it's like if you look at just people who get, a lot of people just aren't getting married, so marriage is going down too. And you know, there was times in my life when I couldn't get women, and I've known a lot of men who couldn't get women who maybe wanted relationships but just were sort of too puzzled and had no idea. I don't know what it is. It's hormones or maybe like too much screens and people aren't socializing and getting out there and meeting other people, but just getting in the first step of like meeting someone and forming a pair bond, you know, there seems to be obstacles even that happening.
Well, come on! If you go to university, it's bloody easy to get into a relationship, isn't it? I mean,
I don't know, Ed. I mean, maybe for you, but not for all guys. And especially if you look at polling, you look at the guys who are sort of involuntarily celibate. You know, it's more than before. And if you look at some countries in like East Asia, I mean, the numbers are really off the chart. It might just be higher baseline levels of anxiety in these populations.
Oh, well, yeah, anxiety. That's just ridiculous. When I was at Leiden University in the Netherlands, there were all these Chinese people. And I organized a British night for this fundamentalist Christian group that I was studying. And I said, right, I want to have a Kaylee. We're going to have, you know what Kaylee is? A Scottish dancing, right? So and quite a lot of the students at this thing were Chinese. And I said, right, everybody pair up. Every boy, go and find a girl and ask her to dance. And they understood English perfectly. And they just stood there. Everybody else, the Dutch people, the English people, French people, they were fine. They would just go, but no, they just stood there. And some of them, I literally paired them up. I said, right, you with her, like that, and made them hold hands. And they're like, ugh.
Yeah. In past generations, they would just be arranged marriage. They didn't need to go out there and just meet someone, you know, meet some stranger. So you could see how sort of they adopted Western sort of norms of going out and trying to meet someone, but they didn't have sort of the capacity for it. It's sort of an interesting theory, because something's going on with East Asia. I mean, you think our country is all in the West.
I met this girl that my wife lived with at university in Aberdeen and just Northern Scotland. She was 26 and she told me she was a virgin. I was like, yeah. 26-year-old virgin. Like, and you're quite good looking.
Yeah.
Like, that was a bit strange. Anyway, I don't know what the politics is behind this or what's going on, or the racial differences or whatever. It seems to me to explain rather more the problem they have in Japan, not so much China, but in Japan and Korea with fertility. If people are like that, people are just sort of...
Yeah, exactly. And it exists also to a lesser degree, I think, in the West. Some guys are just too nervous, they can't approach women. But yeah, East Asia is just a sort of extreme example of this.
It is. Do you see yourself as occupying... I mean, we've talked about the American politics and so forth, and wokery and your criticism of white identitarians and all this. Do you see yourself as occupying any particular side of the political spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can't deny that I'm, you know, conservative. I generally think Republicans are better. I don't like some of the theocratic stuff, you know, the pro-life stuff I really don't like. But in general, yeah, I mean, I believe in markets. I'm anti-wokeness. And, you know, that's you know, these are the two main things that determine our politics.
What do you think will happen with the 2024 election? Do you think, which side do you think is likely to... come out on
Trump? So it's going to be, you know, I've been saying for a while, it's not a big prediction now, but that it would be Biden and Trump. I've been saying that for years, even though the markets didn't necessarily think so. So it's going to be Biden and Trump, and it's going to be a toss-up. I mean, the Republicans have underperformed in every election since the Dobbs decision. I really think that the abortion issue hurts them a lot. Trump is a smart politician, so he's going to do his best to try to neutralize it. Maybe he'll do a good job. But I think that Trump is just sort of the demographics are like the young people and the racial demographic. Well, maybe it's actually not that bad, because Trump could actually do a little bit better with minorities. But I do think that the Republicans sort of, Trump has a lot of baggage, and Biden obviously is incumbent. He has baggage too. But Trump's baggage and the Republicans Party's baggage in the era, the post-Dobbs era, I think probably gives, Democrats a 60% chance of winning. Not a sure thing. You know, it's going to be close like the last few elections. But yeah, Biden and Trump, and likely Biden.
And do you think it'll result in rioting and general disorder if no matter who wins? Or
no, I don't think so. I've been very bearish on American civil unrest, civil war. I wrote an article for the Washington Post, I think in 2020 or 2019 on this. I think there was a January 6th that sort of was a unique, kind of situation where Trump had to be president, Trump had to lose, and it had to be close, and like all that had to go together to sort of make unrest. I think that, there were some, large protests after Trump won in 2016, looking at the other side if the Republicans win. But there wasn't violence. I don't think anyone got killed or anything, and I don't expect it to happen this time.
What do you think, finally, you're well known now for your book on wokeness, but what do you see as the future of wokeness over the next 10 years? How do you think it's going to develop? Do you think there'll be a reaction against it and it'll sort of begin to fizzle out, or do you think it's going to become more gung-ho?
I think it's already started. Now, there's a couple things working, in sort of cross purposes. First of all, you have, if you look at the polling of young people, I mean, it's frightening. How, what the things they believe. Now, the extent to which you can trust those polls, I don't know, because I see so many contradictory things. I think that pollsters are sort of grifting. I think that a lot of these polls are low quality. So I've seen recently that like young men are now 50% Republican. At the same time, you'll see like 70% of young people agree that like whites are oppressors. And it's sort of, it just there's a lot of things here that seem inconsistent. The bulk of the evidence says that they're very right wing and or very left wing. And that's what the next year. At the same time, if they're left wing, it's because of the informational environment. It's because they grew up in the era of social media where right wing ideas were censored. I don't know how you're on YouTube, by the way, now. YouTube must be not as censorious as I remember, as censorious as I thought. But now you have Twitter.
It's extremely censorious. Yeah. So you just can't talk about certain things, and that's it.
But you're on, right? You haven't been censored, have you?
So I don't. Well, yeah, I've had videos taken down. They don't give me advertising revenue. But I don't. Yeah. They don't. You can't discuss race. Essentially, that's out. You can't discuss transsexuality. You can't discuss homosexuality. It's a whole list of important topics that you just mustn't discuss.
Right. So you do. I mean, you do have Twitter. I mean, I guess that's the big one. And then Substack, of course, which they're trying to censor, which is, you know, a person can build their sort of audience without much interference there if they're a good essayist, although the essayist might not be as important as the influencers on Twitter. They might not reach as many people, but they'll reach an elite audience, have maybe downstream effects. So there's these sort of things working at cross purposes. You know, I do think that like wokeness is a sort of anti-human nature. I mean, I think, you know, like, for example, like transgenderism, like, can that keep growing indefinitely? Like, I don't think so. Like, you know, I don't think you're going to get a lot of people to take hormones and, you know, change their gender. So there's just some natural sort of limit that these things reach. I'm generally optimistic that it'll get better. I mean, I think that we've gone through various eras. I think our politics was more we had crazier politics and like crazier sort of left-wing activism in the 1960s and 70s and the 1980s and 90s. And now we've sort of swung back 2020. And I feel like the pendulum is swinging a little bit back, you know, just since the last few years. So short-term, optimistic that things will probably get, you know, somewhat better.
Okay. Ralph, finally, what are you working on at the moment? Have you got a new book project in mind, or what are you currently working on?
No new book project now. I mean, people can go to my Substack. I have essays, you know, a couple times a week, richardhananya.com, on Twitter. I'm doing some stuff on the gerontocracy. If I write a book, it might be on that. Maybe I'm just sort of feeling my way through it. But people can follow me on Substack and social media and, you know, keep up with everything I'm doing.
Excellent. And of course, they should read your book, the full title of which is
The Origins of Woke.
Hold it up to the camera. You got one there?
Pull it out after the thing. Yeah, so you can get audio book and Kindle. You can get the and some good blurbs here on the back too. I don't know if you can see that.
There you go. The Origins of Woke, chaps. So that's, you can get that over on Amazon and all such places. I'd like to thank Richard for coming on. It's been a jolly interesting discussion. And I will see you all soon. And goodbye.
Thanks, Ed.
Are you ready for the future of the West?